Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I'm your host, Matthew Miranda. On a lovely but insane May afternoon, I don't know how your lives are going right now. It is the last week of the semester, so my classes are full of students that are just, the poor things are so overwhelmed and have so much work and so many questions, and this is where the last week or two of every semester, my life is just ticking off emails and meeting with as many people as I can, as quickly as I can. But it is a stressful time for the students, and it is also a stressful time for the professors. Don't forget that professors are people too. Just because kids are sweating doesn't mean that we are not also sweating. It's also a stressful time of this year just because of sports. And I am in the unique position, I have realized right now, of existing in all three states of matter as a sports fan simultaneously. The solid, of course, is Manchester City, who continue to just solidly roll over all of England and Europe and all their competitions, feeling good about that. The liquid state is the Knicks, who are now down 1-0 in the second round and whose season can still take a lot of different shapes, especially as people keep turning ankles left and right. And sadly, the gas, the Rangers, New York Rangers now up in smoke after one of the worst ways that you can lose a series, which is to dominate thoroughly in all the wins and just not put it together in the losses. So I am solid, liquid, and gas. It's interesting. We'll see how that evolves. I'm very excited about today's episode, and our guest is already here, so I can't wait anymore. I have to introduce our guest, and I have to get to the questions. Our guest, who I've been hyping for weeks, author of the must-read Always Affirming Basketball Feeling Substack, a writer for Dime and Gaming Society, whose words have also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Slam, Rolling Stone, Yahoo Sports, and Flagrant. Flagrant is a sports art magazine that you really should be checking out. She's one of the great humanist sports writers of the here and now, and therefore, in the parlance of our times, one of the great humanist sports writers ever. I would like to welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show, Katie Heindel. Katie, how are you doing today?
Hi, Matthew. I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for having me and for that very lovely intro.
I try to end on a good note so my later questions don't become too much of a disappointment. But thank you very much for being here. I've been a fan of your writing for a long time, and I'm really excited to get to pick your brain about a number of sports stories. I want to start, I'm going to ask you a few about some of the pieces that you've written recently, but I want to start just with two or three questions about some things happening right now in the world of the NBA, one of which hit me last night with an exclamation. It was actually a terabang. Like, there was the exclamation point of joy and then the question mark of, like, why am I even questioning this? So James Harden last night, in case you don't know, with Joel Embiid out for game one of the Sixers series with the Celtics, had an enormous performance. He scored 45 points. He hit a game-winning three-pointer in the final seconds. And as most people follow the NBA know, James Harden has often struggled with a checkered playoff history. Mm-hmm. My question to you, I always wonder this. James Harden could have retired a month ago, and he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. He doesn't have anything left like he has to do. I can't imagine someone in 1971 watching Jerry West and thinking, like, he's good, but, like, where's the title? Like, I can't respect Jerry West without a title. Does James Harden, to you, does it matter? Like, is there anything that this person can do at this level that is going to fundamentally alter, like, your perception of them as a player?
I mean, I might be the wrong person to ask for this, because I feel like watching James Harden in that game last night, I was kind of like, this might be one of, if not the best playoff performances of James Harden's career. Mm-hmm. And to me, that shows that he's, one, got, like, so much more ceiling to go. And, you know, a part of that is perhaps he's got more runway. I think maybe I've just always been a Harden skeptic, and that might just be the circuitous route he's taken, you know, since he left Houston. Actually, no, I'll take that back. Like, even since his last few seasons in Houston, I was in Houston recently, actually, and I was chatting with one of my cab drivers, and he was talking about that era of the Rockets, and I was like, oh, you must hate you must hate Westbrook. And he's like, no, no. He's like, Rockets fans like actually appreciate what Westbrook tried to do. It's James Harden that we can't stand.
Interesting.
I mean, this is just one man's opinion, you know, I thought he had some good, he knew his stuff. So I have kept that in mind of like, this guy hasn't really proven it. I don't think he's proven it since he got to the Sixers. And last night I was, you know, eating my words and was kind of like, certainly a ring is never, to me, it's never a be all end all. I mean, I know it a lot in an NBA career is just driving toward that. For Harden, I think it would take a lot of the skepticism out of the room, certainly for me.
Do you think he cares? Like, I know you can't project James Harden's person, and I know all these people are different, but I try to think as a, like, as a writer, like, there are certain writers I've read, like, let's say novelists, who can approach a point of success where it seems like they don't have an editor anymore. Like, they can just write whatever they want, and it's going to go out there. And that strikes me as like, okay, like, you've achieved that level of success that you don't need to care. Maybe sports is different because there's literally tens of thousands of people giving you real-time feedback on your performance, but it always strikes me as like, I felt good in my neighborhood if I like was the best player in a game, and this person is one of the literal elite handful of players in the world for 10 years, and you have to still wonder, like, is it on his mind, like, does it drag on him? You know,
I think it's on his mind. There must be something gnawing back there again. Then there were seasons when I would think, like, James Harden just seems like he's happy to be there, happy to find the local dancing establishment in any given city that he's visiting. Seemed to really be happy to be in the moment. But I always wonder when guys get to the end of their careers in the NBA if that doesn't start weighing on them a little bit heavier. And I do think all the optics and the framing and the talk around the Sixers, certainly since he arrived, and previously with just Embiid and Simmons, has been driving towards like title or bust, or else like, what is this team for? And I would almost say a title at this point for the Sixers would have like a dual purpose, I think, of putting the process thankfully out of its misery and, you know, giving a different kind of stamp of, I wouldn't even say approval for James Harden. Maybe it's more like certainty.
Nice. I like that. Speaking of potentially unfair scapegoats, Dylan Brooks today. I've never seen this in my life. So Dylan Brooks, who infamously recently called LeBron James old and then just disappeared in every way possible after that, he's a free agent this summer. And Sham Sharani reported today that Memphis announced that they will not re-sign Brooks, quote, under any circumstances. I cannot remember a team ever declaring that they will not bring back their own player under any circumstances. I mean, players have committed violent crimes and their teams don't say that about them. Now, Brooks is an easy target. He disappeared after he made the comments about LeBron. His team obviously had a disappointing end of the season. Doesn't it send a bad message to opposing free agents that you would go out of this way to condemn your own player? Or is it possible that the Memphis as an organization is practicing self-care, being brutally honest with Brooks and giving him a head start on looking for a job somewhere else?
Yeah, I think there is an element of self-care here, if not spacing. I was actually chatting with David Roth before we started recording, because a couple of us are in a group chat and we are talking about, I was like, the wording of this report is so strong. And like you, I had been like, I don't think I've ever seen this before. Just like this no chance of him being offered like a contract to come back. And David mentioned that there's the local Memphis paper has a more fulsome report of it. And it's that he was asking for more of an offensive role. The team was like, well, you kind of got to hit your shots, certainly your threes, if you want that to happen. I know they had offered him an extension midway through the season, and he definitely something that he's probably looking at and being like, ooh. but a part of me is like, if you're going to lean into the role of being the villain and the heel as hard as you did all season long, it's certainly not the outcome anyone in Dylan Brooks would have wanted, but it seems a possibility. And, you know, to your point, Yeah, it's disheartening that a team will distance themselves like this from a player when it's just on-court performance, at least if that's how it's being presented, and not when there's more nefarious or harmful, things in play, and that they're really, it all goes back to the money in this case and what makes a profitable team. And that's like a competent team that's well put together. But a part of me also wonders if just the optics and like the feedback from these playoffs wasn't just starting to wear on them.
Yeah. And I feel like Memphis, understandably for some other reasons that I'll maybe bring up later from a piece that you wrote a while ago, like there's obviously maybe more pressure on Memphis than usual to like try to publicly get their house in order before they move forward. Speaking of forwards, Jimmy Butler. So I'm a Knicks fan. I admit it. I have been a long time, and thus I have a lifetime of pain and suffering from the Miami Heat. And yet I love Jimmy Butler. He's always been one of my favorite just humans to watch. The way he plays, the joy he brings to it, everything he brings to it. When he went down with the ankle injury in the fourth, like I was as upset as if any Knick had had that happen. Like, I love watching him play. I'm curious what players maybe for you in the league are just have this irresistible effervescent, whatever quality it is, that just whatever you're doing, if you're flipping through channels and you see that person on your screen, like you're going to at least wait a little bit because it just brings you something to watch this person work.
My unjustifiable faves, as I call them on Basketball Feelings podcast.
I love that.
Yeah. Jimmy is definitely one of them and has been for a really long time. I also will say, I'm glad to hear you say that as a Knicks fan, because there is something that you just want the full breadth of competition, even if you're a Knicks fan. And at this point, I'm sure you're like, you're looking for, you wouldn't mind having a little bit of an edge on a team, but you don't want this coming back around and being like, well, would it have happened if?
Exactly.
And I also will say it surprises me because throughout these playoffs, in the back of my mind, I've been like, well, imagine what the Heat would be like if they were at full capacity. But they are. I think it's just that in every playoffs past, injuries nagging them. And now, like,
yeah,
a sick part of me feels like, did we will this? just based on like past
send your expectations. But
Russell Westbrook is another one. I'm actually pretty upset that he's out of the, I was happy he could go to the Met Gala, but I'm upset that he's out of the postseason so soon. I was really enjoying watching his kind of joyful, I wrote about it for Gaming Society, but this like joyful kind of comeuppance he was due and got, at least in the first couple games of that first round series. Russ doesn't always choose to play defense, but when he does, you know, he's electric, and I would watch him airball and have watched him airball about a million threes, but I would continue to, because there's something so compelling in it, in someone who's just so free flowing and is like, you know what, I'm going to shoot from anywhere. And I'm very unapologetic about it. Kyle Lowry is probably another one. And that's, I think, just like a deep seated, the Toronto fan in me, especially that Raptors era when Kyle led that team. And just, again, watching him take over a game, how stubborn he can be, how much great just court sight he has. And he's always perpetually, I think, four steps ahead of where anyone is. He's like a little psychic terror. Yeah.
He is a terror.
Yeah, those are probably my top three.
I've been very happy this year to be wrong. I was very wrong about Westbrook. I didn't understand his fit with the last few teams. Really, post-Houston, I haven't understood what teams were doing. And when it became, after it became clear, when he was traded to Utah, but everyone knew he wasn't staying in Utah, and Paul George, and I think maybe Leonard, but definitely Paul George, like publicly advocated for the Clippers to go after Westbrook, and I could not figure it out for myself. I'm like, there's something I'm not seeing, because everything you see, but I have to say, like, watching him as a Clipper was delightful. Like, it was just, and like you said, I can watch Westbrook. For some reason, he's a player that you can watch shoot air balls. Like, I don't know if it's the his insistence on himself in a where you don't see that so much, but there's something individualistically captivating him. But just watching him, especially the game where they beat Phoenix, and he was like brilliant. He was all over the offensive glass and defending and everything. I have a friend, Neil Gabler, who he's a writer for a few different publications, and he was covering when Westbrook first entered the league. Westbrook was at was invited to some like Olympic, I think it was like the tryout camp. So they're watching everybody compete against each other. And Gabler told me like the first takeaway everybody had in this gym full of the elite was that nobody played harder than Westbrook, like nobody there. And I think that's remarkable that all these years later, he is just still pushing it. You mentioned the Raptors. I want to know, so did you grew up, I'm guessing, as a, were you originally a Raptors fan? Like, were you following before they were there? Yeah.
I'm from Toronto. I'm based in Toronto. Mm-hmm. I moved away a little bit for school and stuff, but I'm back here and I voted. So the Raptors got their name by a vote-in contest in the Toronto Star, which is our big paper, where you could write in and vote for one of, at that point, I think it had been narrowed down to six names. Okay. I was in elementary school and Jurassic Park had come out like two summers or so before. So obviously I voted for the Raptors, but yes, I've been invested since day one.
Nice. So as a Raptors fan whose team is not currently represented, I'm curious, I have no interest ever in like predictions of who people think will win, but I'm curious, just we watch teams for different reasons with different histories and everything. I want to know series by series who you want to see win, and nothing to do with should they, will they, but like Celtics and 76ers, does either team for any reason appeal to you advancing more than the other?
No. I feel like that is the most self-conscious.
Do you hate both of them as a Raptors fan?
I don't hate them both as a Raptors fan. I will admit it's more frustrating. The Celtics have done some awful things to the Raptors, and the Sixers are a very frustrating team to watch the Raptors play, because in past iterations of the team, they just would fall apart. But I think Tyrese Maxey is growing into one of those guys I just love watching. So like watching him fly around the floor last night, I was kind of like, is he redeeming this team for me? So it might be Sixers. And, you know, to our earlier discussion on Harden, I think out of that, it might be Sixers. Sorry to Boston fans.
There's no wrong answer. If you ever pick against the Celtics on this pod, you are correct.
Okay.
Nuggets Suns. Do you have any strong feelings? I like the continuity angle. Like, I like the idea of a team that has been there and I like Jokic and they've been struggling, versus the kind of like, who are you people just throwing it all together at the last minute and daring to, but that's just me. Do you have any feeling either way in that series?
That's the series that I keep actually forgetting about, if that gives you any indication of how, like when I'm like, who, okay, these are the matchups we've got. What a good second round. What's the fourth team? And then I will actually, I had to Google it yesterday. It was like NBA playoffs to get the schedule like right. I get Suns. I think, you know, as a fellow horse girl, and Jokic's too, and Murray's Canadian, so I'll go Nuggets.
Okay, so far so good. What about Lakers Warriors?
This one is truly a toss-up, and I think it will change for me night to night. Maybe I would like to see LeBron shut down the Warriors, just because it would be really cool to see him do that again.
I rooted against Golden State pretty much every year that they started winning titles. Like, I love them, and I've always rooted for them against LeBron, but this is the year, and I don't think I've always had a thing with LeBron where I've always rooted against him, in part because I don't think he needs to win to prove what people want him to prove. Like, I don't think he needs that. But I would love this season to see. I'm really interested in what the reaction will be in a year where everyone, understandably, like completely wrote his team off months ago. What you're going to have to say if he somehow pulls this group and just gets to the finals or wins it, I think would be, it would be a lot of interesting conversations if that sort of thing happened.
Yeah. And it would just go back to this like singular will of LeBron James, right? When you're like, you have that team that was truly trash, excuse me, to start the season, you know? And he's made some as like a team builder. It's always like completely astounding. Like, these are the guys that you picked. But this one especially, you know, took the cake. So I would like to see that, just for this singular, the proof of like the singular power of one man.
And then, of course, last but most significant, and there is no wrong answer, of course.
This is tough.
I know you have Lowry. RJ Barrett is also Canadian. I just want to point that out. from Mississauga. Do you have a preference, Knicks Heat?
Is it Wiggins or RJ that has the horrible nickname of Maple Mamba?
So they have both been called that. I associate it more with Barrett. God knows where.
Yeah,
he's not the Maple Mamba. But
nobody should be.
I'm gonna do a little deep dive in on that. I want to see the history of Maple Mamba and how that if now it sounds to me like a curse that gets passed from one Canadian high draft pick to another. Let me look into that.
Okay. This is tough, and I was sweating this since we started this line of questioning, honestly, because I have a lot of friends who are long-suffering Knicks fans, mm-hmm. and I want it very badly for them in one capacity. I'm a huge Tibbs fan.
Why is that? There's a lot of Knicks fans who are not huge Tibbs fans. I'm curious.
As a coach, like, leaves a bit to be desired. You don't necessarily want him, you know. I wouldn't want to be on his team as a player. I wouldn't want my body run into the ground night after night. But young Tibbs, gotta harken back to those photos for anybody who hasn't. Google young Tom Thibodeau Timberwolves.
The hair and the pecs. Oh, you're going just back to the Wolves. I thought you were going back to like the 80s young Tibbs.
Oh, that's even better. But there's one photo, and you know the one I mean, where he's like throwing a glance over his shoulder in a gym.
He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Matching like windbreaker.
Yep.
Track pit. Like, no, windbreaker. Yeah, nylon wind pant combo. Okay, but I've stalled enough. I'm sorry. I have to pick the Heat. I have to.
That's fine.
I gotta do it.
Things can certainly change, but I do not hate this Heat team. Mm-hmm. I love Butler. Always rooted for Larry. Adebayo is very easy to root for.
Love
Eric Spoelstra is very easy to root for.
Love Spo.
I do not hate this team at all. Mm-hmm. Asterisk, there is still time for that to change. Let me ask you a question about the New York team that is not in the playoffs anymore, and I'm not picking on them at all by saying that, but when you wrote recently about the Brooklyn Nets, you used a description I had never thought of, and it was perfect. You described the Nets as, quote, a traveling nightclub, a distant Studio 54, which I love because in my head, every time since I first learned about Studio 54, it doesn't compute as a reality. Like, I know it happens. People tell me it happened, but the idea of celebrities and everyday people dancing and partying together, like, I can't compute it, especially in New York City now. Like, I can't, it would never happen. And it got me thinking, and you made this point too, I think, that the Nets were more captivating as an idea than they probably ever were as a reality. And there wasn't enough of a reality maybe to dive into, but they were so interesting as a premise. And it makes me think about that Fyre Festival that was like a whole fraudulent scandal thing. Like, are the Nets Adam Silver's Fyre Festival, where like something is supposed to happen, everyone believes it's going to happen, there's a lot of investment? No. Is that a fair comparison, Katie Heindel?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. It's like, I also think that part and parcel with that food, you know, the pictures of like that weird cheese sandwich that was going around at Fyre Festival, I do feel like that. For a while, when James Harden was on the Nets, all he had were those smoothies he was walking around with. And I feel it's like, on one hand, you're like, oh, great. I bet they've got a great chef and they're making them whatever they want. But then it's like, what if it's just smoothies?
You want to know what's going on in there.
The Nets to me were always very, like you said, you know, they were very captivating, but it was such an individualized team. And that description kind of hit me actually the first time. That version of the team with the star trifecta, you know, of Harden, Durant, and Kyrie Irving, actually not Irving because it was in COVID and he couldn't come to Canada, but when they came to play the Raptors, and the way that they walked out of the tunnel during warmups and how each one of them was so kind of individualized, and there was almost this like, it felt so flashy. It didn't really feel like, I love watching warmups too. It's one of my favorite things about covering games, is just kind of milling around, never know who you're going to see, you know, watching these guys kind of exercise and throw up shots. And I just, it's so mesmerizing to me. It's like very kind of comforting and almost so dull and nice in its dullness. But there was something about those warmups that was the absolute inverse of that. And, you know, even I felt like Patty Mills and Seth Curry, these sort of more workaday guys, were getting pulled into it. And it felt just so like glitzy. I was like, what is this team? Like, this team isn't a team. This team is just individual people on a team, better known for the names that they have than the way that they all play together. And I think that is what panned out, because what was it, like 22? Or no, it might have been even less. There's like the number of games that those three actually ended up
16.
Playing together.
16 games together. 13 and 3.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was really overestimated.
You gave him a lot of credit.
Yeah, I did. I did. It seems like it should be more. But yeah, like for that amount of games, like just over a dozen, we never knew what they were. And excuse me, I guess we never will.
And I wonder, I've seen this more and more the last few years. I'm curious if you have seen anything similar. When I look at, for example, when Game of Thrones was, you know, big monocultural weekly event, there became, for me, it became annoying to have to hide online, because there was like a faction of people that wanted to solve all the spoilers. And like, I just want to watch the thing and have it unfold and get it. Same thing with the MCU. If you follow the MCU, there, before any movie comes out, people are already cracking the Easter eggs and where is this going next. And the Nets reminded me of that, in the sense of like, it didn't seem to matter what they actually, like what they gave you in the moment to think about was more meaningful than what most teams give you like in the reality. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, and sports fans are obviously a heterogeneous mess. Like, it's not like fans want this one thing or the other, but it did strike me as a question going forward, if like, is it as important going forward for teams, allowing that the Nets were an exceptional like situation? You don't see that a lot, but in this ever evolving relationship between fans and teams, and like what the public feels entitled to and what the players increasingly rightfully feel like, no, you're not entitled like to everything from us. It does strike me as a curiosity moving forward of like, do we care as much? Like, when you look at the popularity of the offseason, it's so much more interesting to so many people than what happens in the season. And like, we see it on our sites in the page counts. Like, when it's a free agent perspective piece, it will get so many more reads. I don't know what the question to all this is. Mm-hmm. I'm just giving you this breathless sort of but like, do you see something there? Like, is there something that, let me try to give you a concrete question. Since you started watching the Raptors, do you feel now that there is any, as the game holistically becomes a bigger deal in all these other cultural ways, has it made the game itself, like, fair or not, like, less important to fans, even to fans of the game?
Mm-hmm. I mean, as someone who has a annual summer column called NBA Summer Vacation Watch that I've been doing for, honestly, this might be its sixth year. Started at Vice Sports and has since like hopscotched around to like a whole bunch of different outlets, kind of as the other ones topple, unfortunately. Yes, I think there's something very compelling in the NBA offseason to not all fans. Like, there certainly are people that just want to watch basketball, and it's always been like that. But I think what the NBA has done and has been so successful at, and is maybe, you know, coming to bite them a little bit, what remains to be seen, is how marketable it's made its personalities, right? But also, I think, I don't want to take away from the agency of athletes, because they've bought into that too. And it, you know, it served them in terms of whether that's just like endorsement deals, things that they launch independently, you know, just through their social media platforms. But there is this, what I've always loved about basketball, I think most fundamentally, is when you watch it, there's no barriers like in a lot of other sports, even in terms of equipment. Right. And in the way that we watch it, like, it isn't an arena, but it's on an open floor. There's this sense that you're so much closer, not just to the action, but to the people playing it. I'm so compelled, obviously, like in Basketball Feelings, the newsletter, and this like dinky joke Instagram account I run of Basketball Feelings, which is primarily just like resharing weird stories of that players are sharing and do like what they're doing in their downtime, the more humanizing kind of everyday aspects of it. I think that's really fascinating. I do think there's a dangerous line to realize you can't actually cross into, we don't actually know them. They definitely show us a side of them more so than in other sports. and get to speak to fans directly, but that never equates to an actual relationship where you could say, oh yeah, I know what, you know, so-and-so thinks, or I know their motives behind something that they're doing. But yeah, I think like all that to say that has grown and kind of snowballed and created this vacuum where we're more interested in the individualized people, mm-hmm. Especially in their movements. You know, we want to talk about free agency and like the off season than the collective teams that they're part of. But I don't actually think that bodes on well. I don't think every team is going to become those Nets that we were just talking about. I don't think that also can't happen, because there's, I do also think the NBA has a tendency to correct itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now we get to the difficult questions portion of the show. I have a couple difficult questions.
Okay.
You wrote about Ja Morant, and you expressed something that I felt, you wrote about Ja Morant a little while ago, and mm-hmm. you expressed something I felt at the time too, which is that like, I really didn't want to see Ja Morant brought out for that atonement tour. Like, I really was uncomfortable seeing it. It wasn't my business. And it seemed like, I think you kind of talked about in your article, like, this was for the NBA. This wasn't for Ja Morant. There was no way in that amount of time he could like tell you he did breathing exercises and now he's good to go. Like, there was no way. But it brought up something that I've seen a lot on some of our sites, and I never know what to make of it. And so I'm just going to ask you, because I'm curious what your brain makes of it. Like, Derrick Rose has been now twice traded to the Knicks in 2016 and 2021. Every time Derrick Rose has been traded to the Knicks, our comment sections erupt with very strong takes about, I don't like this in general because of what he's been accused of. Well, you don't know what I'm not getting into the Rose situation, but, and I understand for Knicks fans, and I know for myself, it's particularly complicated by the fact that the organization has been convicted of systemic sexual harassment to a point that the plaintiff, Anuka Brown Sanders, was given more money than she requested by the jury because they found it so egregious. Here's what I'm getting to. I can't figure out why I can listen to Michael Jackson's music and not think about everything else that goes with Michael Jackson. I can watch an episode of Seinfeld and not think about Michael Richards going on a racist rant at a comedy club. It's harder for me in sports sometimes. And I don't know if it's because I care more about sports. I'm curious if you ever have a similar circumstance where like sports is somehow, whether you can explain it or not, a different field than other entertainment, you know, mediums. Do you ever have a moment like that where you're trying to figure out like, why do I let this go or not let this go in sports versus other mediums?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I do think it's twofold. I think some of it goes back to what we were just talking about, how, you know, the NBA has created this vacuum of itself where everybody's getting sucked in to all elements, you know, not just the gameplay, and this idea of knowing people and, you know, that kind of like ownership of fandom. I do think that exists in all sports. I think that's why what makes being a fan of sports so emotional, you know, and so heady. And for some people, I think, and this is something we haven't really reckoned with, and I'm always so curious about, is it's their only emotional outlet. It's the only perceived acceptable emotional outlet, which is problematic in its own right. But I think that's what makes it such, everyone's got such fierce attachments, you know, to their own fandom. So I think that plays into it. I have a hard time, I think, just like being a woman in the space and covering sports, I always have a hard time disconnecting from like the particularly violent or really awful things that we hear about. I remember actually being surprised by how physical a reaction I felt. I think it was the first time I'd seen Derrick Rose in person when he came to Toronto with the Knicks, and I was covering that game. It was, you know, going back to warmups, I was watching him warm up, and I was just like, I just didn't feel good watching it. I just like some kind of awareness. And I'm not being like, oh, the sixth sense of a woman. I just mean like having an awareness, you know, of someone and, you know, the violence that was in their past. That's hard for me. I can't really separate it necessarily. I also don't think the NBA has gotten it right, or really any sport, or maybe even generally society with this kind of stuff of how we ask people to atone properly and that doesn't have to ostracize them completely from the world.
No middle ground, like, at all.
We are not there yet, and that's fine because it's such a messy conversation, but there kind of needs to be, because I think once you ostracize someone, you know, and I've seen this just in my real life, when you ostracize someone from one community, they'll just inevitably move to another and do those same horrible things there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, and that doesn't change just because of celebrity, you know. If anything, the shroud, I think, is, it's more of a safety. There was something else I was going to say, and now I'm forgetting what it was. This is just, it's kind of an open-ended question mark to me as to why I think we just adopt sports and the people who play them so personally and figure out reasons why. The Rose thing is really fascinating to me because I think people continue to come back to him because there's this perception that he never got his shot, that he didn't have a chance even to like fail or flame out because of what happened to him. And it's always presented as like, these hardships that he kind of had to suffer through. And it shouldn't be, but I do wonder if in his most fervent fans, if they do feel like that, it's like, oh, he didn't get his chance, when it's like, he had plenty of chances and like renewed chances, probably more than he should have had just in terms of his actual talent and skill level, which dropped like way off, not just because of injuries, but did just drop way off, I'd say, after he left the Bulls. So, I wonder, it's like always such an open-ended thing with him, but he is perpetually that one guy who can drum it all up again and again. And I think, aside from everything I've just said, it's like, I don't really know why.
When he scored, there was a game he scored 50 with Minnesota, and the reaction was like, he split the atom. It was like the most incredible. And you're like, okay, like, and to what you just said, I think, how does it happen with Rose and with fans? You said something that I think his name is John Wilmes, W-I-L-M-E-S.
He
wrote a great piece about a month ago. It was about there was a beef between a Washington Wizards fan and Bradley Beal. After a game, if you don't know this, listeners, a fan screamed, cursed out Bradley Beal, told him that he cost him $1,300 on a bet. And Bradley Beal went over to the group that the man was in. There were words exchanged. The fan is now suing Beal for apparently knocking his hat over. And Beal told the guy basically, like, rightfully, like, I don't give a blank about your gambling, this and that. When Wilms wrote about it, he made a point that I hadn't thought of. Like, I've had guests on and talked a lot about my anxieties about the rush to just let gambling permeate everything. I think is disregarding problems that nobody, that the powers that be aren't taking into account because the money's good. Wilms made a really excellent point in his piece that one of his anxieties is that it's two things that we sometimes forget about, especially because of the size and the wealth of these athletes. One, increasingly you're talking about teenagers. As the league is going to allow more and more younger people into it, and they're changing the draft eligibility, like, increasingly, especially late in games where points can swing wildly in games that are out of reach, there's going to be more and more young people, even teenagers, involved in those moments. And you have on the other end of the spectrum, and you kind of hinted at this in what you said, like, grown-ass men who don't have any emotional outlet for anything in their life besides sports. And there's this collision that, like, is really not fun to imagine coming between those two forces. And I think it's something similar also with, like, Derrick Rose this year. He hasn't played in months. The Knicks had a great season. They don't need him. Like, he's not a part of it at all. Even in the playoffs, if they are up big late in a game, the rush from the crowd to chant his name, it makes no sense historically. He's not like a great Knick from the past. He doesn't have some innate history. But I think, like you're saying, it's because people remember everything they associated around that time and their feelings, and not the man probably at all. It's interesting.
Yeah, I really like that piece by John. And I think that's what I was alluding to before when I said, you know, the NBA has created this product where the face of it, the public face of it, is its players. And that served it so well in terms of its, you know, really rapid expansion and how you get international fans to latch on because they're latching on to personalities. They're not latching on to the product, really. That's usually like the first inroads is a kid sees LeBron or AD or Ja play, and it's like, okay, you know, now I have an interest at least in this one person, and that will get me farther into it. But the flip side of that now is, you know, you've invited betting into everything and everywhere. Like, I think Natalie Weiner made a joke about this. I saw like a couple of weeks ago, but just like, you know, I bet in 2 years we're all going to be working for FanDuel or something. Just like that. It just feels like that's the, and I write for Gaming Society, which is granted, it's like a player led. Kevin Garnett founded it with Jamie Messler, who founded Players Tribune. Mm. And it's rooted in the idea. Well, it's rooted in the fact that like most women don't feel comfortable betting because either they haven't really been marketed to, but it's still betting. Like at the end of the day, it is still betting. But so I'll just say like, there's a lot of like, there are a lot of companies trying to get like a piece of this pie now, but that's, the NBA has also caused this. So I'm really curious to see how, you know, the more vitriolic reactions and interactions that we have with fans, because like those existed already. But now when you've got someone who's just like, maybe just straight up has a gambling problem and lost like all their money on like a Wizards game on like a Tuesday night. I don't, its own like problematic line of decision making. But there's no divide there. You know, we're talking about lines and not stepping over lines. The NBA has created this new one where there's like really not a lot of separation. So I kind of wonder, and your point, like that, the point about some of these guys being kids, like when they come into the league, and they're also like, they're really young. I think that's the thing too, like the framing of like LeBron James is ancient is awful, but these guys are young, and yeah, they're insulated by money to a degree, but you shouldn't treat people like that. You shouldn't treat anyone like that. So the NBA has created a problem. I don't think it wanted or anticipated, and I'm curious to see what they do about it, because there have to be protections in place, I think, for athletes. And it's going to get way more toxic, I think, and way more the psychology, I think, of how fans are going to watch and root for, and the things that they'll look for in games will change. I'm not necessarily looking forward to it, but I agree, like, there's going to be a really new, uncomfortable wave of things to come.
And I think this is one area where sports writers can have a tangible positive impact, because I think I it's chicken egg. Like, there's dehumanization. There always has been. Sports is like, it started now. But when we as writers will talk about players as assets and as pieces, and when we sum them up to like their contract value relative to the market, that is part of the continuum, I feel, that leads to, I don't see you as a person anymore because the money's so crazy or whatever. You know, whenever I see a sports writer call an owner a governor, like, it makes me want to jump out of my skin. Like, this is not a political, it's not an office. They're beyond public accountability. Like, don't do them a favor. Don't do the league a favor by saying that. So hopefully the writers can help contribute to that in the future. Do you have time for three more questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sweet. next question. And this came up for me a lot. So one of the sites I write for, this is the first year that we covered it's the first year we're covering the WNBA, and we're covering the Liberty. And I was so pleasantly stunned by what it's like dealing with the WNBA to get like press credentials versus anyone we try to deal with the Knicks. Like, the Knicks have told us straight out, don't ever ask us, because we've been critical. You're not allowed to be critical of the Knicks.
Right.
The WNBA was literally like, awesome, here you go. Like, it was so... And I recognize there is a different, there's the WNBA is, they're all growing, but the WNBA is an earlier stage in its development. And sometimes I wonder about, this is a stretch, but I'm going to tie this back to shoulder pads. When I took women's studies classes in college, one of the things that Jessica Nathanson, who passed away right after I graduated, rest in peace, Jessica, she had this great lesson about how it's not progress if you're making the new people fit like one way of being. So one of her points was like, is it progress in the 80s if there are more women in corporate environments, but they're wearing like business suits with shoulder pads, and they're not going to get pregnant because that's not a way you advance, because that's not the way men have advanced. So there's this obvious, like, we don't have to do it because we did it a certain way before. That's not necessarily progress. You wrote a piece a while ago about one of the facts of the piece was that at the NCAA Women's Championship game, I think the highest ticket prices were like $466. The lowest ticket prices were $466. Mm-hmm. And when I see that, it makes me wonder, like, I know as a... This is a stretch, but I'll get there. I know as a Knicks fan, like, or a Met fan, you know, if I'm a Met fan, if I go to, like, when the Mets are playing in May and they're not good and they're playing the Pirates and nobody cares, I'm the kind of person who will be there. A lot of people will not be there. When the Mets are good and the prices go up, now I'm not the person who's going to be there. People who can afford it are going to be there. So on the one hand, no question, the growth and the obvious, and everyone's known it for a while, who's not, I think, like, just anti-women's sports, just like men's sports, you have to put the product in people's way for them to see it. It's not the other way around. The NBA, there's a famous story in the 60s of when the NBA players were going to boycott the All-Star game because it was the first time it was going to be televised, and they knew the league is desperate to have our product on TV. Mm-hmm. We have a leverage point. We'll take advantage. Is it – I don't want to ask the question too simply. Let me try to – when I see – cheapest prices are $466. I think this is not good because the people who have been there and who were watching Dawn's Daily 30 years ago, like I was, are not the people who can afford $466 to fly. But I understand it's a national event, whatever. But is there any concern that women's sports might just follow the pattern of like hyper-capitalist men's and like our definition of what success will mean for that? You know, the WNBA announced a few weeks ago that there will no longer be reporter access in locker rooms. Like, and a lot of people I know who cover the WNBA were not really thrilled with that because they say, understandably, this is when we build relationships with players, all this stuff goes on behind the scenes. Is there any concern that you have that we're glad that this is growing, but we don't trust the avenue or the people who are leading it in that path of growth? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think it's too early to, I don't think it's a bad question, but I think it's too early in the growth curve of certainly the WNBA. And I don't, like, I'll preface that. It's like, I'm not saying it's just, it's a new organization, but it's too early in the growth curve to start putting, I think, those sorts of questions forward, because I'd rather see it proliferate and grow much bigger. Though I also acknowledge what you're saying is sometimes these things go hand in hand. As some dude thankfully pointed out to me in that, when I mentioned that price point for the Final Four game, was like, that's in a I don't know what the stadium was. He's like, oh, that's a basketball stadium, and the men's game was in a football stadium. Yeah. So yeah, it is also availability. There was tons more tickets available to the men's Final Four than the women's Final Four, which, you know, to your point, is more reason to put these games in bigger venues and larger stadiums, because that will even at the price point, and it will make it more accessible for people to go. One of the big things, there's a WNBA game in Toronto in the coming weeks, which I'm unfortunately going to be traveling while it's here. It's at Scotiabank Arena where the Raptors play. The tickets sold out, I think, in a day, and then they hit the resale market. They're high, just as high, if not higher, than Raptors tickets, which are to the point now where it's a barrier. A lot of people can't go. One of my hopes of that game was that, and if Toronto does eventually get an NBA franchise, a WNBA franchise, which is what's been kind of floated, is that it becomes a more affordable price point for families to be able to go to, because basketball has grown so huge in Canada, but a lot of people can't afford to go to Raptors games. So they'll go to Raptor, like to 905 or G League arm team.
Yeah.
And I hoped that, you know, if the W came, you could definitely see this is a lucrative market, but let's not limit ourselves right away. Let's do what you're talking about and make this more accessible, because the more accessible you make it, the bigger the product it becomes in the end. And that is how these leagues look at the sport. It is a product. So I think to a degree, what was exciting to me about the Final Four is just we so often the economics of the women's Final Four and March Madness in general was more interesting to me this year because, you know, they were first to sell out all their sponsor spots. Maybe that's because they didn't have as many as the men's tournament, but they sold them out. They sold out all the commercial spots all the way up to the finals in advance of the finals. There was just so much money there. Where in years past, you know, we've seen the treatment as secondary or like they didn't even want to call it March Madness because it might confuse some people. Right. So I think it's good to have the money there. And that's why I liked that ticket price point, because it showed there was this demand and a very intense demand for it. I don't like the flip side of it, that it creates a barrier for people to actually come and access it and view it in person. But I do like that women's basketball is being looked at as a profitable, lucrative potential for advertisers, because that can only really lead to good things in terms of accessibility in the wider market, and like just simple stuff like getting it on TV, you know, getting it not on like ESPN 7 or whatever, like at time in the middle of the afternoon.
Right. And I think in the interest of justice, you're good to remind me and people, like, even if you're well-meaning, you can't compare the WNBA at this stage of its development or women's sports to leagues that have been on TV for 60 years. You can't compare them. All that's going to do is work against something that's trying to blossom. So thank you for that reminder. Two program questions, neither of which is about sports. Katie, I grew up many years in Western New York, where Canadian culture is very, very strong. We love our Canadian bands. Back in the day, it was Kids in the Hall and Plum Sauce, and we can use Canadian coins anywhere we go and they're accepted. That's how embedded the Canadian culture is to us. I want to know, you wrote, I loved this line in one of your pieces. You wrote, watching as an outsider is easy, and not growing up in the States, not having college loom as large as it does here, means I'll always be a bit pressed up outside the window looking in. But where the door has been opened for me, I find myself getting comfortable. I would like to know something that you recognize in people as distinctly American and not Canadian, both positively and negatively.
Interesting. I would say it would have been harder pre-pandemic, maybe pre-Trump, to pick a negative thing. honestly, because I spent a lot of time, my dad was a DJ his whole life. So self-employed, started his own business. But we didn't, because like summer was his busiest season, a lot of weddings, weekends also busiest time. So we did a lot of road tripping, and we predominantly did road trips through the States. Also my dad just has like I know so much about the Civil War. He's like a Civil War buff. Huh? Yeah. Okay. Nice. Been to Gettysburg. But, you know, growing up with that, I always thought it really interesting when I had friends in, you know, in Toronto and Canada growing up, who were like, oh, I don't like Americans, or, you know, they're so different, or they're really rude. And it's like, actually, like, that had never been my experience. You know, I actually found most Americans to be much friendlier, certainly more friendly than people living in Toronto. I just found like most Americans more open, more willing to just kind of like make small talk, shoot the shit, like have conversations, ask questions, you know, really an open curiosity, which I always really liked. That has changed, I will say. It's tough to pin down. It's more a feeling, I think, in the times I've now been to the States. I noticed it the most in my first trip post, like, the pandemic's still going, but like post big pandemic, which was going back to Vegas for NBA Summer League, which I go to every summer. So it had stopped for one summer, and then the first summer back I went, and Vegas is also a strange melting pot. It's not necessarily a true sample size of America,
it's something.
It's because everybody's there. But it just felt like there was this guarded feeling, more guarded, I think, than I had ever experienced before. And, you know, in the times I've been back since, whether that's for work or to visit friends I have, though granted, a lot of my American friends live in the microcosms of New York or LA or kind of those surrounding areas. That feeling has just, I've just noticed it a lot more. I don't know if there's a lot more fear, and I understand why, you know, as an outsider seeing what is happening, and it seems like a scary place to live at times, but it also just seems like that fear is being constantly rebroadcast to Americans, and so often, and just on an infinite feedback loop that you can't escape it. So you're always in this panic mode. And I think that's creating much more closed off. And this kind of like, I think we even see that in a lot of like the discourse. You can even go back to this, like with just strictly NBA, this kind of like gotchaism and the need to really like dunk on everybody and prove a point and not get into a discussion where you might learn something or be proven wrong. And I've written about that before, especially around like the Kyrie Irving, you know, situations of this past season.
Oh yeah.
But I wonder where that's coming from. I mean, there's obviously big implications of lack of funding and education and, you know, healthcare and all everything that everybody, like Americans, I think have to wade through and to live. But that's become more obvious to me in a way that I don't really like and definitely feel for. But it's, that kind of like openness and eagerness has shut down a little bit, which is a bummer.
There's been a kind of a spiritual tonight, a social tinnitus since that happened. You can just hear it. It's there. It's been there ever since. It hasn't gone away. Like you said, there's a lot of reasons probably behind it, but it is distinctly observable. Mm-hmm.
But I will say I still get excited. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. No, go. I always get excited, even if I'm just doing like cross border, like if we're driving to Buffalo or something from Toronto to hit the outlet malls or to hit Trader Joe's.
Yeah, the border guards.
I always get excited. There's a different feeling. I'm like, I'm in the States. Like there is a feeling, and it's not just a bad thing. There, it's just sometimes maybe that's like a holdover from childhood trips, but you know, it still's. I've got like that. A soft spot in my heart for it.
Super cool. Super cool. Hey, let me close with a grammar question for you.
Oh boy.
I'm ready for it's an opinion question. It's not a test.
Okay.
This comes up a lot with my students, and they're never able to give me an answer. And I suspect that you will. In one of your pieces, do I have the quote? I don't. In one of my pieces, you make reference to God. God is lowercase. I have no beef with that. But my question is, whenever my kids write about singular God lowercase, and I ask them, why is it lowercase? Often the reason is because like they don't believe in God. And I'm like, well, you don't believe in Santa Claus, but you capitalize that, right? And I say, yeah. Why is singular? This is not a test at all. I'm just curious. I really want everyone to know this. I'm not starting the Inquisition. I just want to know why the lowercase God.
I think if this is it in the Jah piece?
I think so.
Yeah. So in that, because I kind of wrestled with that. I remember because I was like, you know, the Santa Claus point is apt. That's a really good argument, I will say. But with that, it's because I knew I was going to hit on different idioms of religion, like different religions. It wasn't just Christianity. Yes. So I think for me in that situation, I was like, okay, God here is going to be far reaching. It has to, you know, be a shroud, to use a bit more religious iconography, over a few other religions, examples that I'm going to use. I had Islam, Judaism,
Buddhism,
and Christianity, too. Buddhism too. That was why.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent answer.
But it's a good call. It also makes me think, like, would I be that teenager that's still like, I'm an atheist and lowercase it if I had to?
Right.
Not sure. Circumstantial.
Yeah. Well, it's a question that I've always wondered about for years, so I'm glad to hear some perspective on it. Hey, Heindel, that is all that I have for you in this episode. I am extremely grateful for your presence and your insights and your continued work. I love to read everything I can about basketball, but I have a limit for how much X's and O's and stuff I can actually deal with, but I can read the human stuff like all the time. So really love your work, really excited to see more of it. Glad to see the basketball feelings continuing to come out in Substack. And just do you have any pieces coming out or anything that you want to highlight or let the audience know to look out for coming down the road?
First, I do want to thank you for your patience because I know this took a little while to schedule with travel that I had. So yeah, thank you for
worth it. Thank you.
Your patience. And again, just for asking me on, this was great. I will plug Basketball Feelings, which we've plugged a lot, but I will plug it because I have started my annual series. It's called Exits. So it's kind of a reflection. It's a loose reflection on every team season as they're eliminated. But when I say loose.
Looking forward to the Miami one. Yeah. So you know,
When I say loose, I mean really loose. You know, we get into history of place, of the people there, sometimes climate, topography, you know, like sometimes it's focused on one person more than the team. Sometimes it's just the team, but it usually has very little to do with, you know, these other recaps that you might be reading. And I'm also excited and happy to say that I've asked a couple of writers I really admire, not all of them within basketball, to guest write a few of the exits, depending on teams that they root for, you know, or just are fascinated by. So yeah, you can read all of those at basketballfeelings.com. The first one is on the Nets. And the next one will be on the Clippers, and that will be coming this week.
Nice. Okay, so look out for that Basketball Feelings Substack. I subscribe. You should subscribe. You should get your friends to subscribe. That's it for this episode. I want to thank you all once again for being with us. Remember, you can follow the pod on Twitter at Jackman Sports. Email any thoughts, questions, suggestions for us at jackmansports@gmail.com. You can follow our guest on Twitter at WTEVS, which I think I just figured out is whatevs, but I wasn't really sure. So before any of you ever write and compliment me about ever seeming intelligent, no, I literally was trying to figure out if it was like the call letters of a TV station you might have worked. And then I was like, literally this morning, I was like, okay, it's whatevs. So WTEVS. Last note for our listeners, there is a short story. I cannot remember the name of it nor the author. It's a story about a pilot, an American pilot, a bomber pilot in World War II. He's flying a mission over a German town. His assigned target is this one building, but he's concerned that children specifically, that it's a place where you might hide civilians. So instead of dropping his bomb on the building, he drops it over an empty field. He flies away and feels good. Years later, he visits the town. He wants to see like the fruits of his kindness. And he learns when he gets there that the townspeople, having feared and known that the building would be targeted, sent all their children to hide out in the field, the same one that he bombed. So all that effort to try and do good amounted to nothing. If you want to do good, all you have to do, subscribe to our Patreon, and you'll manage more than that pilot ever did. Patreon.com/Jackman Sports Show. That is it for this episode. Thank you, everybody. We will be in touch with you probably in about a week. Peace until then.